to the Troubleshooters podcast with me, your host, Mike McGrath. Now, today's guest resides in Chicago and runs a very large logistics business called Link. Luke Petherbridge hails from Australia originally, growing up in Sydney and forging his career locally at Rubicon and then Macquarie Bank during the GFC. Our conversation provides a fantastic insight into a phenomenal success story. Australia, as you know, punches well above its weight in both business and sports. So sit back and listen to how Luke, from humble beginnings, rose to the top. Luke Petherbridge, welcome to the Troubleshooters podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Michael. I really appreciate it.
People won't know this, but this is the third time of you and I trying to connect. We've had some technical difficulties, but we're delighted that you can hear me and I can hear you now, and we can get this podcast underway, which I've really been looking forward to having this conversation with you. Now, I think it's fair to say that you're big in logistics, Lou, and ostensibly what that means is, I mean, you employ 1,100 staff, just to put it in context, and I think you've got 9,000 businesses that rent space from you. Tell us a bit about Link. I know it's backed by Blackstone, and it actually was founded in 2019, remarkably. So tell us a bit about Blackstone and Link and what you do at the moment.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, you touched on a lot of great stats there. Link was really founded in 2019. We're one of Blackstone's many portfolio companies, so they're our equity and partner in growing this business. But, you know, we're a real estate company. We are in US logistics, warehouses. We're one of the largest owners and operators in the country. And to give you an idea of scale, we have a little over 3,500 buildings. You mentioned 9,000 customers, which can range from the largest e-commerce provider or Fortune 500 companies down to the smallest little incubator that, you know, and which always make me wonder just about the breadth and depth of the US economy. Mm. Yeah, 1,100 people, we have 60 offices. And the stat, which sort of gives you an idea, around about 5% of US GDP will flow Link building or Link customer in our building, which gives you an idea, like we really take our position in the US economy and supporting the growth of the US economy and our customers really seriously. So it's an awesome, and I'm very fortunate to just be a little cog in what is a very, very incredible wheel.
Link specializes in what they call the kind of last mile. So tell us what that means.
Yeah, so if you think of, you know, everyone probably knows a warehouse, if you think of warehouses, and I think the last mile really sort of accelerated here in the US probably about a decade ago. Warehouses probably, you know, since the mid-1900s through, was very much just moving large goods around, putting it at a store. What really changed in sort of 2013, 2014 was this phenomenon of e-commerce, Amazon, and Amazon Prime went past 50 million subscribers here in the United States, where we sit today, 22% to 24% is online. But the thing that's really shifted is speed. So for me, probably this really started when I was 30. And this whole notion of buying something online and it being delivered to your door in a week was like mind-boggling. It's like, this is amazing. But now that here in the United States, in most big cities, you can order it in the morning and it's there that afternoon. Like most goods are delivered within 24 hours. That growth, Amazon says, is like 30%. It's their fastest growing business. They call it sub-same day. So speed and execution of e-commerce has really meant you can't have the goods sitting out in a large warehouse way out in a rural location. It's got to be infill. So our thesis has been accumulating and owning these infill, last mile, close to rooftop facilities where workers live, where buyers live, and close to the retail nodes that sort of serve community.
Yeah, no, it's been a phenomenal journey that online, you know, I remember in 2000, I mean, I'm old, Luke, you're a lot younger than me, but I remember that, you know, everyone was predicting what was going to happen online. You know, we started out with websites and then we were what was being predicted was all this e-commerce, and it was massively overhyped for a long time. And then all of a sudden, the iPhone appeared, smartphone appeared, and everything changed. And it's like, aha, now I know what you're on about. And since then, well, you know, it's phenomenal, isn't it? I mean, did you say 25% is online?
It depends on the, but yes, 22 to 25% of the US is online.
Yeah.
COVID became a huge accelerant and a change of consumer patterns. And I think if you read most research, it probably says by the end of the decade, that gets towards 30% online. It continues to grow. If for no other reason, we spoke about briefly, I'm going to drop my eldest son to college. So he's 8.
Yeah.
He's more digitally native than I ever was, and I am.
Yeah.
And just as we age, as demographics age, the biggest buyer in their 30s are millennials. They're going to buy more online than my era, than my parents' era. So,
yeah. You
know, time and aging will just mean this continues to swell. And the services got dramatically better. Like, you can see where your packages are get delivered within 24 hours. That e-commerce accelerant is just one of the many tailwinds that are sort of driving demand to last mile and logistics in general.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. Look, to those who are, I'm sure many of our listeners will have picked up the fact that you've got an Australian accent, so you hail from Australia. We're talking today from Chicago. I presume that's HQ, is it, for Link Chicago?
New York and Chicago are two big.
Okay, cool. So tell us then, before we come back to Link and that story, tell us how you got started in business and, what was growing up like? And what were the first signs that you were good at business, Luke, that emerged? And when did they emerge?
Still waiting for those first signs to appear.
No false modesty, Luke.
I grew up in Sydney. I grew up in Cherry Brook, so a suburb. It was awesome. I mean, you say the lucky country. It is. I mean, I think Australia is just such a great place to grow up. I'm very much Australian still. And it's a place we love to visit. My family's there, my wife's there. So, beloved, I went to Macquarie University. I started working at a big investment manager in investor relations, like dealing with investors. And then I went and worked for a small business that was a hedge fund that got into real estate and grew rapidly. But I got to work with the founder. It was exceptionally driven and smart and taught me so much.
Was this Rubicon?
It was Rubicon, yeah. That's it.
Okay. And so you got there at 23?
Yeah, in 2020.
Okay. And so you speak about a baptism of fire there. So tell us a bit about that, because I got into business at 23 and I had a different but similar baptism of fire. But talk to me about what that was like.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I got to work with a very driven, focused founder who was, you know, exceptionally bright. I mean, he built a business. And, you know, when I first joined, I mean, I was in a small suite in Double Bay. And, you know, I do everything from get the mail and collect coffees to help write PDFs to raise money to help, you know, do book builds on IPOs, which we got to do over time. We listed a US, a Japanese and a European REIT in Australia. But it was really that the opportunity was just to be around the hoop with just all this activity that was going on. 2003 to 2008 was such a great era of business. But, you know, it was like intense and you worked long hours and the demanded. I mean, I remember Gordon would say things like, you know, a jack of all trades or a master of everything, and don't wait for tomorrow to do something today. And everything matters, like everything from presentation style to format to wording to the way you, these things that are instilled in you in very formative years. I probably honestly didn't appreciate the lessons I was being taught as much as now. And I don't think you ever do when you're grinding and shoulder to the wheel. I don't think you appreciate as much, but when you look back on it, it's those lessons that really are the foundation stones to how you run and how you do things. I'm sure it's the same as when you learned your lessons in your 20s, but I was very fortunate to have the opportunity. I had to make my own life being there and working hard, but I had a real opportunity to learn. And 20-year-olds, my advice, like, when you're there, absorb as much as you possibly can, ask questions, test yourself, push yourself. And Rubicon was a real opportunity for me for 5 years.
Yeah, it's interesting that concept of learning, getting in a place where you're going to learn a ton. It's almost like the seller is a bit academic. If you can get into a place and around some people, those, as you said, that's foundational, isn't it? Really. And you know, everything I've done is really, you know, it's some way, shape or form was born of that first 5 years, right?
You said salary is academic. It's so interesting how you define that. I think if you said to a 20-year-old, you get paid in learning and money, and when you're in your 20s, you get paid a lot more in learning and not as much in money. Just value it. Like, you know, value the opportunity to learn. And, you know, I think at times I absorbed it and I thought about it, but now I look back at it, it's like, wow, there was so much that I saw in that period in my life that I apply every day, even today, which has been really helpful for my career.
Luke, I love that twist on that old saying, jack of all trades, master of everything. I really, I can kind of...
A little like, it's that constant, you know, pursuit of better is probably another one.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bit of hyperbole there, but there's a truth in it, isn't there, in terms of... You know, and that ready, fire, aim, that, because effectively you were building a business more than doing a job. There was a business being built. And I think there's a distinction there.
I think that's right. I think I was fortunate to be alongside the business builder and see the inner workings of how to build a business. And you're constantly, and not in this failure, you fail fast, move on. But, you know, just the intent focus on everything matters, from the work using emails to the order to the formatting of a press release. Like, these things are instilled. And by the way, so many great businesses instill this thing. You go work at a big investment bank that's exceptional. They instill these things into you that at the time feel like rote learning or a grind. And then when you're in your 40s, like I am, you're like, wow, all these things just instilled in me. But one, learn, but two, the other thing which I've been fortunate in my career, just work around great people that challenge and inspire you. If you do that, like, I didn't sit there and say I want to be in real estate. I didn't sit there and say I want to live in Chicago. Like, I just my path with working with great and inspiring people, and that's been very lucky in that sense.
Yeah. So where was the love of business and commerce? Was that nurtured in you, through your degree at Macquarie? Where was it where you went, okay, I'm good at it. This is what I'm going to do.
Well, I wouldn't call myself a stellar student. I did enough to get a degree. My dad, he built his own accounting practice. He had 40 or 50 people. Like, he built a real business. I mean, he built... And all my life, from where I remember as a kid, like, you go on the weekend to get things, or he was working on it, but he built a real business. So I think just looking at the influence dad had on me and what he did, my mum then worked there for a long period, and was really instrumental of my love of a business and, you know, commerce. I did commerce at Macquarie, but, you know, I think that's really where it started, and it's little things. And I would say even wanting to live overseas was my parents talking at a kitchen table about when they lived overseas and all these things. It's just, it's innate when that, you know, earliest memories. I remember, you know, dad building a business, talking about it and hiring people, and it was really interesting. So I think that's probably where it started from.
Where did the opportunity to go overseas come, and how difficult was that to jump at? I mean, was that, a big, I know it's a big move, but was that a big call, or were you just in?
Do you know, so I went from Rubicon to Macquarie Bank and worked on one of their satellite listed vehicles, and the partner was from Cleveland called DDR. So a $15 billion shopping center REIT. I joined Macquarie just before the GFC. I think 2 weeks before Lehman went under is when I joined Macquarie. For those that aren't bankers, it's not a great time to join an investment bank. right before a crisis. Great learning opportunity. I got to work out a vehicle and work with very smart people. Macquarie is exceptional. The board was great. But I got to know this partner, this JV partner, and their people. I used to travel to Cleveland a lot. And, you know, when we sold it and wound it up, the CEO and the CFO, who I got to know really well, said, would you ever think of moving to Cleveland? Now, for those that live in Sydney, I would say Sydney is the most beautiful city in the world. I'm a Sydney-sider. I love it. It's awesome. My joke is Cleveland's the second most beautiful city in the world. It is not. It's a great Midwestern town. It's nothing like Sydney. It's on a lake, which is beautiful. It has great people, but it snows a lot. The weather's not like Sydney. But, you know, we just thought, why not? Let's give it a go. Like, I think a mantra in my life has been open to yes. Like, what's the worst thing that happened? Try. We had two little kids. Let's go live in Cleveland for a few years. And if we don't like it, we can come home. And I would give my wife, Chantel, a little credit for this, that she was probably a little bit more. She lived in the UK as a gap year. And like, why don't we do this? Let's give it a go. And so, you know, it's not easy to do. I'm not saying moving from anywhere is easy, or anywhere, by the way. I mean, your accent shows that you're moving's hard. It's worked out phenomenally well for our family, for our individual selves, for my career. It's been really great.
It does indicate a certain spirit, doesn't it, of adventure and sort of, I guess, a risk appetite. Well, where did the real estate expertise and kind of love of real estate, where did that begin to germinate? Was that at Macquarie?
It was at Rubicon. We did three listed vehicles. They were all real estate. I got into real estate. Then Macquarie, I got into retail real estate and helped run a business with DDR, and then moved to DDR, which got into like the true operating platform. And DDR had 700 or 800 people, but, you know, became the CFO there over time. But it was like a real operator. You had a leasing team and accounting and property management and development. And that's where, you know, that was a real opportunity to learn a real operating business and be fascinated by, you know, motivating people and working with great people and harnessing everyone's individual skill set for a common goal. That was a real opportunity for me to learn that. And, you know, that was the first time I'd really been, I mean, I worked at Macquarie, but I worked in a silo. It's where I had quite a large purview with a bunch of other members. And I learned so much from a great number of just how to be a good leader and inspire people and communicate with people, I think was wonderful.
You mentioned the GFC not being a great time, you know, to do what you were doing. I started in M&A in the GFC as well, so I had a pretty lean first couple of years, let me tell you. But you mentioned that it was 2019, which is that sort of pre-COVID period where you got Link going and you got the gig there. So tell me about that kind of, you know, from a troubleshooting point of view, right? I mean, coming back after Christmas in 2019, I remember it well, and the whole pandemic thing was emerging. We were Googling the word pandemic. I mean, how did you tackle that and what was the experience like?
Yeah, so when I left DDR, I started a firm called ShopCall with Blackstone, which is a retail real estate business. Then I moved to LiveCall, which is multifamily, or built to rent is what they call it in Australia. So I went into COVID running those businesses. And then a year into COVID, maybe 6 months into COVID, they asked me, would I step into Link? And I moved to Link. It was a lot bigger. It was a real challenge. Like, even just think about managing a platform or a team. So forget about the issues of, are we collecting rent? Are we looking after customers? How do we lease space without seeing people in this pandemic world? Imagine trying to run a team. We hired 400, 500 people during COVID. Everything was virtual. I think what me, honestly, is the resilience of the human, right? Like, just our ability to be resilient and resourceful and solve things. And things we thought we'd never have to solve, like collecting rents or, you know, managing move-ins with customers and you know, unlike Australia, the US had various different COVID protocols. Every state was very different, so you have to manage that. But what I found was if you hire great people and surround yourself with great people, they invariably come up with really unique solutions to big problems. But, you know, for our business being in industrial or warehouse and logistics, there was this first moment where everything became, wow, what does this mean for the world and GDP? And then it was this effectively like a rocket ship because everything went to online. We need more inventory in the United States. You still remember that image of all those tanks, the Port of Los Angeles trying to get in. Good. So it became this a massive accelerant for our business, for e-commerce, for onshore manufacturing, for safety stock. So our business went through like a 2 or 3 year hyper boom. So not only were we building a business and sort of caught fire in a very positive way. We started finding, we got to really do some great things here.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, there were definitely winners and losers, weren't there? And, you know, if you were in the airline business, I remember Virgin here had $1 billion in cash in March. They were broke 6 months later. I mean, there were some real problems for certain sectors. And then other sectors, like you said, online just went through the roof.
Yeah. And then there was all these businesses that started that tried to take advantage of that or serve the customer more. Amazon has been a leader. Walmart's been a leader. They're doubling down on this. They're growing still at, you know, that last mile, some same days, like growing at double digits, more than double digits even today. So
yeah,
really changed consumer patterns. It changed where people live. Like this Sunbelt acceleration happened during and post COVID. So there's been big shifts in the US that, you know, are now standing the test of time. And so building a business around that.
As we come out of that now, I mean, I can't believe it's 5 years ago now already, but it almost seems like a blur, to be honest with you. But you don't have to be living in the US to observe the political polarization there. It's interesting that we've got a second term of Trump and we've had a lot of choppiness around tariffs and stuff. So how's that affecting you and how are you guys thinking about managing the whole kind of tariff volatility?
Yeah, I think, you know, the thing I would say to that is the world is dynamic. Things change, whether you have tariffs, whether you have a boat going sideways in the Suez Canal that shuts down GDP flow, whether it's port strikes. I think, you know, the supply chain globally in every country is a little fragile and it's constantly trying to, what we've tried to do is we try to help our customers navigate changing landscapes. That could be changes, it could be GDP change, it could be political changes. So we really just take the view of the long-term view of owning great real estate for our customers to operate in today and tomorrow. And then provide solutions wherever we can as they, some businesses are going to grow in this, like manufacturing is accelerating. You know, there's a lot of data centers being built, but all those components need to sit in a warehouse, solar, batteries, EVs. And there'll be other businesses that need to shrink. So we're constantly trying to toggle. And I would say over the next decade, 20, 30 years, the last 50, there's just always cross currents and changes occurring. And we try to work with our customers to navigate that the best we can.
Yes. It's interesting that, I mean, in some ways, the mid-market, which many of our listeners are running relatively small businesses, that they kind of live with this choppiness and change. It's kind of part of the MO that, you know, in fact, one of the strengths of a small business is its ability to flex and change and adapt and, you know, if it can't lose that, because that's its greatest defense, I think, against these larger competitors who are typically they're stronger and bigger, but they're often slower. But it sounds like, you know, you guys are reasonably nimble and you take a fairly pragmatic view of, I mean, change is the only constant, right?
I think that's a great phrase. Change is the only constant and you try to be as nimble and as flexible. And really, we all have a customer, work around our customer, but we try. That doesn't mean we're perfect at it. As you get big, you end up with bureaucracy. Like you try to avoid that. You come up with rigidity. Like you really try to be as nimble. And I do think, you know, as you think of mid-market firms, I think of the customers that are in our building. This is exactly the sort of people that your listeners are. These are these small to middle-sized enterprises that are building a widget, whether they're fixing every bag. Like if your bag breaks on an airline, you ship it to a facility, a linked facility, there's a business that looks at it, fixes it, or replaces it. Or every Starburst wrap is printed at a linked facility. There's all these businesses, and this unifying thing is they're all these dynamic businesses that are constantly managing and flexing for changing conditions. And I think resiliency of small business, both in the US, in Australia, I'd say globally, is the backbone of a lot of our GDP, of a lot of the global GDP is these small businesses. So we write our own buildings that they can operate in, and we try to make it as easy and user-friendly.
I suppose, I mean, I've had a 40-year career effectively, and, you know, I've kind of mapped the digital, you know, we've gone from no computers on the desk, you know, no mobile phones to we've mapped that, and we've now seen the largest five corporations in the world are all weren't around effectively 50 years ago, and now they're the largest five. So, I mean, that's been a phenomenal thing to watch and observe. But many would say we're still at the beginning of this kind of digital age. And what are your thoughts on AI? Everyone's talking about AI at the moment as a huge catalyst for further dynamic change.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard for any business not to think through it. I think we are trying to challenge ourselves with it and embrace it where we can. I have sort of my thinking probably will evolve as well, but I think of it in three broad buckets. I think of AI being able to support, you know, what we call robotic process automation. So getting rid of the lower value tasks, automating those, which we've been doing, like business has been doing for a long time, whether it's using it in your accounting software, Adobe, DocuSign, all of that stuff, and then using AI around that will just help you become more productive as a firm, focus on higher value components of what we do. So we're doing that. Then the next one would be cognitive engagement. So the way we sift through our data and the way we can deal with a customer, or the way we can actually, you know, get insights back to our employees. So how's the human interaction with the platform and what we do, whether it's our chatbot, whether it's the way you can bring up data or use an agent to help you work with a customer. And then the third one would be cognitive insights, which is where, you know, we are one of the largest owners of industrial real estate in the country. We have so much data from leases to customer insights to what they've said, and the drag these insights out to be a better partner and better real estate for our customers to do better at. So they're the three areas where I'd say early inning. I think you're exactly right. We're in the early innings of this sort of, I'd say, revolution, but we're constantly learning and testing and trying things, and things work really well. And some things, you know, we're waiting for technology or, you know, a tool to sort of catch up with us.
Yeah. Just reflect for us on, you know, what would some of your big milestones be? I mean, at Link, but generally that where you've made some good calls, and when you look back and you get that perspective you spoke about earlier, you go, wow, that was a good call in a difficult situation.
When I was at Macquarie, I think it'd be hard not to sort of say what was the lessons learned in the biggest financial challenge of my lifetime, the GFC. I think when I look back at that, you know, this business was under immense pressure. It was listed. There was a huge amount of pressure on it from banks. I think the biggest thing there, which, you know, we sort of hung in there and solved it and got the business sold eventually. It was like, just don't give up. I remember a board member, Bob Joss, was on the board. He was on the board of Citi. He was the dean of Stanford at the time. I remember him calling me one night, like crazy late. He was in San Francisco, but it was late in Sydney. And he's like, character is forged in crisis. So these moments that are really hard is where you determine you can build your own character and what can you do. So I think that was a huge opportunity there. I think when I had the opportunity to leave DDR and go and build Shopcore, I can remember that distinctly, where they, you know, I had a chance to build a firm. And really it was like, you had merged a bunch of things together. I got to re-architect everything. I didn't know if I could do it. I'd never been a CEO of an operating platform. But, you know, I think that formative moment of learning and being okay to fail, like it's okay to get things wrong. I think leaders and, you know, particularly senior leaders feel like they can't have errors. I'd say the things you learn in the most difficult situations is the ones that probably are most lasting. So being okay to test and fail on things. And then where you sort of, at Shopcore, built a very customer-centric business because we care about the retailer and the retailer's customers. At LiveCore, was very data-centric. That's the way you can run 80,000 apartments, is very data-heavy. And then at Link, it was trying to merge those two components together into a business that was very transactional. We've been fortunate on that. That doesn't mean I don't bump into things and get things wrong, and we have to backtrack and go down another fork in the road. But you know, we've really sort of stretched ourselves. But the commonality is surround yourself with great people, and great things will happen.
It's interesting that you mentioned persistence there, because that's our number one value here at Oasis Partners. And yeah, we're constantly reminded of the need to just keep at it.
Yeah.
I remember Churchill apparently spoke at the Oxford Union, and he just walked on the stage and just stood there and just said, never, ever, ever, ever give up, and then walked off. The guy standing ovation. That's all he said.
He's like one of the most inspirational leaders in history. But there is an element of truth to that, I think. You know, I think it's never give up, or persistence, just keep at it, keep moving, keep going. Sometimes you'll be going backwards, but just keep going. The other thing I would tell my 21-year-old self, when that situation's happening, that is your best opportunity to learn the most. Like, keep your eyes wide open and learn the most. It's when things are really challenging is where you can learn the most. I'd say, you know, although the world was good, we did so much at Rubicon, I learned a lot. Macquarie taught me so much, because it was the worst cycle, part of the cycle. But I think when things are really hard is when you can learn the most. But that is probably the moment that you naturally are trying to just shelter and just keep your head down, just be like, please let it go past. Well, I think the greatest leaders that sort of eventuate are the ones that when they're in the teeth of the wind, are like, I'm not going to give up, and I'm actually going to learn more and outperform, because they're the lessons I'll use later in life in a different situation. I think they're the people that are...
I mean, I think, you know, one of the illusions is that success is a straight line up, and, we get presented with these situations in the media where everything looks like it was an overnight success. And I think that, you know, we've got to teach our kids, and you know, about resilience and about these, the life is hard. You know, I remember the first line of Scott Peck's book, The Road Less Traveled, is life is hard. And if I remember nothing else in that book, I remember that first line, which is, okay, I got to own that. It's not easy. And you don't have to speak to people for very long without coming in touch with the fact that life is hard.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about all these mid-market firms. If it was easy, everyone would do it. And I mean, they're every day. I mean, if you come around Link and we toured our facilities, you get to see all these businesses, these companies that rent space from us. They're every day, like, there's challenges every day in these businesses, and they turn up and they keep. And that resilience, I think, is admirable. And it's what makes Australia great, what makes the US great, what makes businesses great, what makes leaders great. But yeah, it was really easy. Everyone would do it. And challenge, I think, creates the opportunity. Like, when there's a challenge, like, you have the opportunity to outperform, do something different, create a new solution. I think the exciting part.
Lou, you've got a one of the largest fund managers as your capital partner there at Link. And I presume you report to them in some way, shape, or form. You've got a board and stuff. Tell me how you manage when things haven't gone to plan and you're having to show up and fess up, really.
Yeah. I mean, well, one, Blackstone, you're right. They're one of the largest alternative asset managers in the world, one of the largest real estate owners that we see in their real estate business. I'd say we just be overly transparent. Like, we really, yeah, it's totally fine to say, we tried this, it didn't work. They're integral in our business. I see them as partners. We all see them as partners. We make decisions jointly together on things. They're very supportive in the business growth. They've been wonderful to work with. They're all straight up in that. But I've really taken the view of, they don't expect me to be perfect. We strive to be better all the time, but we push to try to find new things to do, and we can fail. And then again, though, I think the thing they would impart on us would be, that didn't work. Why didn't it work? Let's not forget the lesson and move forward. So I think they've been, well, I don't have, I'd say giving them bad news has been relatively easy, because they're like, great, now what? How do we learn from this? What was the lessons? How do we adjust the strategy going forward?
You're clearly an outstanding operator, and congratulations to you. It's phenomenal to see an Australian go to the States and run a business like this. We would love to see you back here, by the way, but I'm not sure that's going to happen anytime soon. But you've got a great humanity about you. Tell us a bit about Core Giving, because what's incredible to me, that in the US in 2025, as many as one in six children are kind of undernourished. Luke, talk to us about that.
You know, I think philanthropy globally is a big thing. It's huge in the US. Companies do it. I think all corporates, we as companies, Blackstone does, we own real estate in communities. And I think it's our onus and our job to lead communities better than we found them. And at ShopCore, we sort of set up this foundation or this philanthropy called Core Giving. And we now have 14 portfolio companies that are partners, our vendors, our employees. And you're right, like the sad state of fact is, like, one in five children don't know where their next meal's coming from. So if the way I personally associate, because it's a very personal thing when you think of this, if you think of like a long weekend, the King's Long Weekend in Australia now, not the Queen's Long Weekend, I'd be so excited not to have to go to school on Monday. There's a number, like one in six kids in the US don't want that week because they get fed at school. And that's a huge thing. So we built this foundation and this charity, and there's so many people that are involved in it. And over the last 5 years with local food banks, we've delivered 80 to 90 million meals around the country. We have like 3,000 or 4,000 people every year turn up to volunteer on Call Giving Day. It's now coming to Australia with our partner down there, 151 Property and Revantage. But it's something that, you know, really the firms at Link and then the other blacks of it, we've united against this one cause, this one common mission. And I think it really comes back to, this is the one, there's so many great causes to get behind. But I just think we want to help our communities. We want to help those that need help. And this is just one of the ways that we've been able to do it. And it's something that we, again, don't give up. We're going to persistently work to try to end childhood hunger.
I mean, just because you can't solve it all doesn't mean you shouldn't try, does it? I mean, that's the point. We've got to do what we can. Well, one of our guys, Derek, went to the Philippines recently, and we funded him and gave him some money. And he was helping a local minister there who's feeding 1,100 kids a week, just a bowl of rice and an egg, right? And it completely changed Derek. It's moved him. And we're now formalizing that charity here, and we're just not prepared to do it as a one-off. Like, that's a problem.
That's amazing. One, send me that charity. I'd love to support it. But it's awesome. And I think, And by the way, it's not just Link and it's not just Blackstone. Like, so many corporates and individuals give time and money and effort to sort of help this. And I think it makes our communities better. It makes the world better. And this is our little niche. We're really sort of working on it. And every year, more people give to the charity. More people want to volunteer with our charity through local food banks. It's like Call Giving Day is one of my favorite days of the year. It's good for my soul. It's good for our firm. It's really been very special. And I've been so lucky just to be part of it. It's been awesome.
Excellent. Look, Luke, that's been fantastic. I know you're busy. I'm very grateful for your time today. Just a few quick questions before we sign off. So what's your favorite place in the world, Luke?
It's hard not to say Sydney, Australia. I do love Byron Bay, but Sydney, Australia, it's home. I love it. I miss it. I miss Australia. My family, I miss you, Mum. Like, I miss us.
Hopefully she'll listen to this. I mean, my mom does, as a matter of interest. But so what about a book? Have you read a book that's inspired you that you'd recommend? Does anything jump out?
The two that sort of Good to Great is a great book. It really instills the first the who, then the what. So hire great people do great things. That's been a theme. The other one that's an easier read than that, which I think just shows humility, is Shoe Dog, Phil Knight's story.
Right, what a great book. Yeah, Phil Knight.
Read that one. It just, when you think of Nike and you just hear how he built this humbleness inside this building where they moved, like I still remember, like they were a huge firm and they'd all turn up and they'd move offices. Like the employees moved to save money, pizza, they just... The humility of this, I think, is like those two books have resonated. I haven't read them for a long time, but two things that...
No, it's a great read, Shoe Dog, isn't it? Yeah, thanks for that. So, and then what would you say to 21-year-old Luke if you could go back and you had... I'm not sure 21-year-old Mike would listen to Mike, but on the off chance you might listen, what would you say to him?
I'd say, I'm not sure if you'd listen. I think maybe three things. One, just be curious. Curious minds solve big problems. Like just be curious, learning, always learn. The second one is be open to yes. Like if someone offers you a job in Cleveland, Ohio, you're saying yes. Don't say no straight away, but just be open. If someone offers you a lateral move, not a vertical move, be open to yes. Be open to yes. And then the last thing is just be positive. Like just be a positive. Have a positive demeanor and an optimist and positive, you know, I just think of my kids or myself. You want to be around positive energy and positive people. And it's just, I think, so it's be curious, be open to yes, be positive.
Isn't that great? Look, you're right. You know, laughter's medicine for the soul, I think. So if I've done one thing, I've tried to make my kids laugh. They've heard most of the jokes these days, but it doesn't stop me saying them, Luke. But look, I think the free market's been a great place to play for me, and it sounds like for you as well, Luke. And I like the idea we've got to be positive. The free market isn't free, by the way. We stand on the shoulders of giants, don't we? And in the liberal democracies of the West, we get to play. And if we're positive and constructive and curious, like you said, good things can happen.
That's right. You've got to work for it, but good things. You put yourself in a position to make good things happen, for sure.
Yeah. Luke, it's been a pleasure. Thank you. And when you're over in Australia, maybe at Christmas, I'd love to have a coffee with you.
Absolutely. Look forward to it. That'd be great.
Okay. Take care, Luke. Thank you. So there you have it. I love Luke's positive have-a-go attitude with his emphasis on curiosity and persistence. And if that's not enough, it's okay to make mistakes. In fact, mistakes are somewhat inevitable, providing we take all the lessons from them. Now, a quick shout out to our show sponsor, Oasis Partners. Find out why more and more owners of Australian private companies are choosing to have Oasis represent them. Contact Don Hunton, the CEO, for a confidential chat. Finally, if you like today's episode, be sure to share it with your friends and colleagues. And if you're feeling really generous, leave us a comment. Only nice ones, please, as we're very sensitive. So, until next time.